This is Rabbi Sharon Brous, Rabbi at Ikar, where we're dedicated to reinvigorating Jewish community, ritual, and learning, all while laying the foundation for a just and loving society. You're listening to Ikar's podcast, where you can hear our sermons from Shabbat and holidays, our teachings, our guest speakers, basically anything we think worth hearing that we can capture and stream, you can listen to right here. The whole Megillah. I mean, literally, the whole Megillah. So thank you so much for being with us.
So about 11 years ago, I came up with this idea of doing something on the criminal justice system. A lot of people talk about criminal justice reform, but very few people actually know what it's like inside. So it's a simple idea. Let's put the audience in the shoes of indigent criminal defendants and follow them through. No narrator, no experts, just put the audience in the shoes and let them experience it for themselves. And the idea, I said this to Rabbi Brous before, it's kind of a case study for the Amen effect, because we want to humanize everyone, humanize the defendants, humanize the guards, the lawyers, the judges, and then let's just see what happens. Seemed like a simple enough idea. I thought it was a good idea. It took 9 years to make and another 2 years before it was on the air. That was 11 years ago.
Wow.
And I can kind of go over why it was so difficult, but the main challenge was access. Getting to public defenders to agree that I could talk to the defendants and I could record their conversations. And the public defenders were afraid of being embarrassed, because most public defenders are overworked. They're really well-intentioned, but the average caseload for a public defender in this country is 500 felonies a year. And they just didn't want the public to see them in those circumstances. I needed a DA who would agree that anything that I heard or recorded from a defendant, they would not seek as evidence. So this way I could go up to the defendants. So they entered the jail and just say, talk to me, you won't get in any trouble. And it had to be in writing. I didn't want anybody taking my word for it. So I could just show that to the defendants. And couldn't find a DA who wouldn't let me do that. And then I needed a sheriff who would let me go anywhere I wanted in the jails. And I tried all over California. I wrote the Chief Justice of California. She loved the idea. She introduced me to a bunch of judges, and they were receptive. But again, the public defenders and the DAs would not cooperate. Finally, I found all over the country, after 5 years, I found one public defender who was willing to let me come into her office, and she was in Nashville. And she saw that the potential benefit to her client community was much greater in her mind than any risk of embarrassment. So she said, okay, and she introduced me to the DA, and it took a long time to convince him, but this was another thing that I really learned. This was a journey. This was a real journey, as you can imagine, for 11 years. But people wondered, how could I get the DA on our side? And I think that what happens with a lot of people who go into professions is they have good intentions, good motivations, and then they just get bombarded with everyday assaults, and what you have to do is get them back in touch with why they entered the profession to begin with. And I think we were able to do that with the DA. And then the sheriff turns out to be this really progressive guy who says that 30%, imagine this was the sheriff I was meeting. 30% of the people who come into my facility are mentally ill. The criminal justice system isn't doing anything for them. take 30% of my budget and devote that to the mentally ill? And how many times have you ever heard a public servant say, take 30% of my budget? And we shot a pilot 5 years ago in 2018, 6 years ago now. And then we had to shop it around. But in those intervening years, the 3 years between the pilot and the production, he had actually taken 30% of his budget and built a facility called the Behavioral Care Center. Amazing. And people were diverted into there, which was great. So that's kind of, so what finally happened, just to orient people, it's finally going to, it's on the air. We made 6 episodes. We shot for 7 months in Nashville. 7 months, we produced 400 hours of footage. And it's really all interviews, all talking to people. And those 400 hours were reduced to 6 50-minute episodes. The first 2 were on Max last Thursday, 2 days ago. And the 21st and the 28th, there'll be episodes 3 and 4, 5 and 6, all on Max.
Mm. Congratulations.
Marshall, it's an honor to be in conversation with you, and thank you for a lifetime of dedication and devotion to helping our country be what it ought to be. I think it was 4 minutes into the first episode that I noticed the first tears welling up in my eyes. We had just met Teresa, who is one of the voices, one of the people, one of the stories that we're following in this documentary. And you just a moment ago said that one of the orienting principles of this work was to see the humanity of everyone involved in this process, both people who are being detained and people who are working in the jails, the judges, the prosecutors, so forth, the prison guards. 4 minutes in, we have learned that Teresa has been arrested for, I believe it was an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
In a domestic violence context, right.
And we see her getting driven to the jail and the intake process, and we see her mugshot being taken. And she says, I feel guilty. I didn't do anything, but I feel guilty. And the title of the first episode, I believe, is Presumed Guilt. Is that right?
No.
Presumed guilty. Did I get that right?
No.
Okay. You know better than I. But I want to ask you about that moment, right? That moment where she is minutes into an experience. Later in the episode, you reveal that on average, people are detained for 6 to 8 months awaiting their trial. And minutes into her experience, she is already feeling like she is guilty despite not being guilty, not feeling that she's guilty. She's expressing that. So can you speak a little bit about how you think the system as a whole, the experience of people arrested or taking into these centers, how that experience strips them of their humanity and contributes to this sense of guilt even before we've gotten to the point in the justice system where they've had their day in court?
Good. I should have said this initially. The honor is mine. It really is to be here today with the two of you and with this community. I mean that. Thank you. It's traumatic to enter the world of incarceration. And one of the things that we do, we delay until the 6th episode actually presenting alternatives, but you begin to wonder, what's the purpose of incarceration again? Why are we putting people through this? I also, we skipped over this in the introduction, but I wanted not just the men's jail, but I wanted the women's jail and juvenile court. And I'd never seen a documentary in juvenile court. And of the people we're following, four are juveniles, three are involved in really serious crimes, and one was arrested on a gun charge. But yes, dealing with the trauma of incarceration is really significant. And you particularly see it with women and children because they're just more vulnerable to the audience and the perceptions. You know, I wanted to use that too as a springboard that I have mentioned before, and I talked about the Amen effect. But I think what happens a lot is most of us, first, we never get to the temple. But then if we do get to the temple, we're in the group that goes to the right. And this experience for me was dealing with people who go to the left. And, you know, there was this question, are they going to talk to us? Turns out they're dying to talk to somebody because no one notices them. No one cares about what they have to say. Mm. And within the justice process, often lawyers silence them. But when I could show them the thing from the DA, the agreement, they were happy to talk. And it's that access was, there's physical access to the jail and the conversations, but it's the human access that we really were most proud of and I think make the show different from what we've seen before, to actually hear people talk about their trauma and what it's like going through. And we have, again, kids, mentally ill people, we have drug addicts, people in serious crimes, people who have no idea why they're in.
I love that. I'm thinking about a conversation I had with Jenji Kohan some years ago about Orange is the New Black, which I think was a transformative television experience because it was such a captivating story and the cast was so great and the script was so great, but what it was doing was inviting people to become emotionally attached to people who are beyond the walls of the prison, who most of the viewers have never encountered and wouldn't engage. And suddenly they're like our friends. We know their stories. We're seeing them week after week and knowing their background and knowing their struggles. And I think that show was in part responsible for some changes, that there was a change in sentencing laws in Congress, in part sparked by the show, because the show opened people's hearts in some way and caused a kind of enough of a groundswell that people were like, wait a minute, this isn't fair and this isn't right. You know, some of the criticism of the criminal justice system over the last couple of decades has been that even the language we use around it is wrong. Like, we say the criminal justice system is broken, and the criticism is it's not broken, it's working exactly the way it was designed to work, that the criminal system was designed to control and to contain poor people, Black people, people of color in this country, and as a result, it can't be reformed, that it's irredeemable, and what we have to do is dream up a whole different way of dealing with accountability in our society. And I just wonder, given that your vantage point, both as somebody who's been in the prisons as a documentarian, also someone who's worked for judges, also someone who's had all the experiences that I shared in your bio, do you think that the criminal justice system is redeemable, reformable, or is there something new that we need to be dreaming up instead in order to create a just system?
Great question. Here's how I've changed. I used to go straight to policy and implementation. Okay, here's what we need to do. How do we do it? And more, I think that the first step is changing minds, opening hearts. And at that point, you can have change. I think until we get people to see what the world of incarceration is really like, I don't have much faith it's going to change. But, you know, I'm a devotee. I believe in hope when all is said and done. You know, the story of Exodus, I'm listening today, that Exodus starts when they're in slavery and somehow they end up 400 years later with the tabernacle. That somehow it's going to take time. But I've seen commitment in my life. I've been very privileged. I saw a man named Clarence Mitchell, who was the NAACP's legislative person, started in the 1940s knocking on doors. Can you imagine that? What kind of promise, or how much hopelessness he was contending with? And somehow he was there when the Civil Rights Act passed in 64. So I do think things can change if you can get people to watch. Now let me say something else. I hope I'm not running on too long with this one, but it's really important. It's hard to get people to watch a show about the criminal justice system, no matter how compelling it is. And I'm, Morris, thank you. I'm glad you gave it a shot, and you know you're with it. We won you over. But I have friends and family who just don't want to watch something that makes them uncomfortable, that in effect, what I was saying before, you can't get them to the temple, and if they are in the temple, they go right, they stay right, they don't look left. And that's what we have to do, is keep encouraging people to look left, embrace the other.
And just to continue with the metaphor, because you know, it's so striking to me. I mean, when I wrote chapter 8 of the book, which talks about the ostracized going to the left, I was really thinking about criminal justice. I mean, I was thinking about Bryan Stevenson and people who are on death row, and like really, what would it take for us to see each other's humanity? But I'm just gonna again, and I'm going to, you know, just remind us again that when the encounter happens from people who are coming this way and people are coming this way, that it's both a seeing of the other, and then a question. It's wonder. It's experiencing curiosity and saying, not assuming I know who you are. I know how much you're worth. I know that you must have done something truly horrible. But wondering, like, who are you, and what do you see, and where? Why does your heart hurt? And tell me about your trauma, because not that that justifies behavior that's harmful to the community, but because it helps us see a person in their humanity. And so I think bringing the kind of curiosity that you bring as a filmmaker, documentarian, into the space is itself a rehumanizing force, right? Even just saying to someone, you are worthy of our line of vision. We're curious about you and your story and your experience of this, is an incredibly powerful offering that you have made.
Absolutely. I really look at my experience on this as a journey into the profound. I really do, to be able to connect with people who have been through that kind of trauma and have them share with us. You know, it was interesting. The plan was meet people as they come through the jailhouse door, follow them until the stories kind of peter out, and then recruit for another 3 weekends. When I say recruit, we're talking 6 p.m. to 2 or 3 a.m. approaching people. And I figured we'd have to do that every 2 months. And we wanted to get eventually we had 12. So in the first 3 weekends, we got 12 people. And their stories just kept going and going and going. And after 4 months, I knew we wouldn't have to recruit anybody else. And I was looking at the wall where we had their pictures, and I'm thinking, wow, aren't we lucky that we got 12 people whose stories lasted
this long, and they would continue to last to this day. And then I said, no, we weren't lucky at all that we could have gone into the jail any three weekends and found 12 people whose stories were just as interesting. They would have been different, but they would have been just as interesting. And it reminded me that everybody has a story if you just stay with it.
Marshall, something that surprised me, and it's connected to what we're talking about right now in terms of placing people in our line of vision and hearing the stories of people who our society collectively in some way has said, we're not interested in your story. We're literally going to lock your story behind bars and forget about you. The messenger, or at least the first messenger of the message that these inmates are people is a prison guard. It's one of the jail guards. And it's early on in the first episode, and he says, some people think of them as inmates, but I try to remember that they're someone's granddad. They're someone's father. They're someone's wife. They're someone's mother. And it gets you to think about how to be in relationship with these people. Why did you choose, in some ways that feels like you are, that is one of the meta messages of this project. Can you speak about why you put that message into that particular speaker's mouth? What you wanted the audience to learn from hearing it from him as opposed to from someone else?
Great, great question. When I sat down with the DA and had that 4-hour talk, He said, you know, you don't want to do this in Nashville. I mean, things aren't that bad in Nashville. And he named some other counties where I should fill. And I said, no, that would be obvious and nobody would learn anything. What I'm more interested in is a place where the system is being administered by conscientious, hardworking people. And let's see what happens then. And that's what we really went after, so that you can't just dismiss the problems of the system by saying, well, they're sadists or they're horrible people. No. And you'll see in the film that for the most part, you can't fault the people administering the system. It's just the system is wrong or has problems, severe problems. We have a judge who, she's the juvenile court judge, chief judge, and she's remarkable. She's an amazing woman. And she believes that that the longer a child, a youth, is in the criminal system, the more likely they are to end up as criminals. And she establishes all these programs to divert 70% of the kids who get arrested. And the recidivism rate for those 70% is 4%. And it's so great. And yet at the same time, Tennessee has this law that the longest somebody can stay in the youth system is 18. So she has to decide, in California it's 25, so let's say somebody's arrested for a murder that's committed when they're 15, the brain's not fully formed, and you can't really make a judgment on the child, the youth, until they're, say, 25 in California, which is great. Then you can see, have they reformed, or are they just so dangerous we have to continue to confine them? She has to make that decision before they turn 18. So you see this person who's trying really hard, very creative, comes up with some wonderful solutions, but the laws tie her hands.
Last night we had, Rabbi Brous was in conversation, we had a book talk with Elise Lewin. And towards the end of the conversation, Elise said to Rabbi Brous, and she was quoting someone, that we ought to be hard on the system and soft on people. I think that's what she said, hard on the system and soft on people. I want to ask you for a moment to be hard on the system. Right? If you were speaking candidly about the problems of the system, what would you identify as the most pressing problems with the system?
Independent of the whole humanity and humanizing issue. The first thing that really hits you is the lack of support for people after they're incarcerated. People become drug addicts for a reason, and the moment they get out, there's no support, and they face stress, and then they become back on drugs, and that's it. It's awful. And there's a lot of people facing drug addiction. Mental illness. We happen to find a place where they do address the mentally ill, but they're so under-resourced. And you'll see in later episodes what happens to somebody who finally is put out on the street, but there isn't the support. So I think if I being really tough, it's the lack of resources for people once they're out. Then the next question is, what is the point of incarceration? What are we trying to accomplish? And you have such human potential. You know, this country it's crazy. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's incarcerated population. And it's not only cruel, but it's a waste. There's so many people who could be productive. And I think that's the next big thing I would change, is to look at ways of utilizing the potential of these people who we've decided to incarcerate.
I have a question for you. I learned some years ago from Dr. Barry Goldstein, who's the beloved member of the community and psychologist. We were talking about the bystander effect and how most people imagine that if we were put into really terrible situations where we saw an innocent person being harmed, for example, we imagine that we would step in to save the innocent person, but in reality, most of us would not. And so Barry was saying to me that there are only two things that change that dynamic. One is if we associate with the person who's being harmed, like we see them as part of our tribe, whatever your tribe is, then we will break the bystander effect and we will get involved. And the other is if somebody warns us before going out of the house that day and says, hey, there's going to be a moral conundrum that you're about to face, and you will be judged based on your response to this conundrum. And then you see someone going after an innocent person, and like 100% of the people are like, here I am to save the day, okay? So I'm thinking about what it means to be a documentarian and to go into these environments where we know that people often are not their best, and you got their permission to film them. And I'm thinking about the person who told you 30% of my budget should go into treat mental illness and actually followed through. And I wonder if that would have happened if the person wasn't going to be on film. And I think it's fantastic. And I wonder if we should try to get filmmakers into every single jail and prison. But do you think that the outcome of what you witnessed was impacted by the fact that you were there to witness it? Were people behaving the way that they were because they knew that someone was watching? And then if so, what can we do to replicate that effect and, you know, think about doing that, you know, big adol in the big scheme of things?
Right. I may be naive, but I think the answer is it didn't affect them. And the reason I say that is we filmed for 7 months. So they might have been on their good behavior for an hour, maybe even a day. But after a while, they've got work to do. And our guys were really good at slipping into the woodwork. And I think we got really candid footage. And, you know, not everyone is a saint that we cover, that we see. But, no, I don't think it affected behavior. I really don't.
Years in the making. This project, you said, was 11 years in the making. And thinking about what this country has been through in the last 11 years, with specific respect to what you have been covering as part of this project, I'm curious if you would let us in on any of the conversations you had with your team as you're watching George Floyd, for example, right, killed, and then the absence of justice in the aftermath, the ways in which legislation is brought forth to Congress and then left on the desks of Congress. And as you are in this decade-long project of making this film, thinking about policing, thinking about jails, thinking about criminal justice, and paying attention to the headlines that are emerging all too often in this country, how did the current events, not in Nashville necessarily, but the current events, the big stories that are happening in this country, how did you and your team talk about those, and how did they, if at all, shape your project?
I'm smiling because the next project I'm trying to get going is on voter suppression. And it's all planned out. We have a deck of 27 slides, and we're ready to make the presentation. But unlike the criminal justice documentary, this one's very time sensitive. And we're having trouble selling it. And I'm smiling because the Criminal Justice Project was just not time sensitive. It was always going to be bad. And all the only time pressure, I mean, I wanted to make it work. I wanted to get it going. I wanted to complete it. But in terms of circumstances affecting things, I didn't see much of a change. And things like George Floyd, it made me want to work harder and get it out to the public faster because, I'm going to address one thing in a moment, and that's how we handled race, because that was a challenge. But in terms of events, no, I don't think so. We knew it was there, no matter what was going to happen. The criminal justice system wasn't changing. Race, and it's especially apparent with juveniles, because in juvenile detention, this judge is black, and she is just a marvelous person. She becomes the moral center of our series. We don't have a narrator, but it's like she's so charismatic, she wins you over. The one thing that depresses her is that in the detention unit where you have serious crimes, it's almost always black teenagers. Almost always. She hasn't had a white kid in there in a long, long time. And you see, this is another response to Morris's previous question. Downstream problems is what I come to think of them as, where, you know, you have poverty, education, broken family. Those show up in the criminal justice system down here, and people are in the criminal justice system are expected to handle that. Whereas if resources got put upstream, this down here would look a lot different. So what we decided to do with race was not say anything. Just it's just obvious. It's just apparent. Wow, is the city all black? Or what's going on? And we have white defendants, absolutely. But most of the people behind bars seem black, are black. And then what happens in the last episode, semi-spoiler alert, but I think it's worth mentioning. We're thinking all along, we have to somehow address it? How do we address it besides just letting the audience see it? Well, we have six black DAs sitting around in a circle talking. They spoke for an hour and a half to one another, and I only asked two questions. This was really amazing. My first question was, so what's it like being a black DA in Nashville? And they just talked for 45 minutes on that. And then the second question was, so how do your friends feel about you being a black DA in Nashville? And that was another 45 minutes. And their discussion was a real way into race without being too on the nose about it. It was much more revealing because they're talking about it as the experience of a black prosecutor who is saying, look, the best impact I can have on the system is to be a prosecutor, not a defense lawyer. So they're really aware, and they're bright, sensitive, really admirable people.
I wonder if there are a couple questions we would love to hear from the community and before we wrap up today. Does anyone have a question for Marshall? Yes, hello.
Hi, I'm Razel. Oh, that's too loud. Sorry. when I was in my 30s and I lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, I volunteered at a woman's penitentiary. And I volunteered to teach about Jewish holidays to Jewish prisoners, I guess. So my experience was that I don't think a single woman who showed up was Jewish. And that really made an impact on me because it was very clear that they wanted to talk to somebody outside the system. And any themes that I brought up, they talked about those themes in their lives and that sort of thing. So I mention this because I wonder, do you handle at all the impact of either classes that are given or people come in from the community and what that does?
People coming from the community as volunteers?
To teach or whether they have, sometimes they have classes that are already, and they're still from outside the community.
We have a graduation ceremony in the jail. We have lots of volunteer organizations we do cover. Most of them are outside. But some are inside too. So, and the graduation, it's actually really neat. They wear caps and gowns, and there's a march down. You triggered something I'd really like to share, if I could. And that is, people have asked, well, what was it that made it successful that you could just approach all these people and they'd start talking to you? And here's my answer, that I had several things happen in my life that I think made it easy to just go up and talk to people in those circumstances. And the first was my daughter, when she was 12, was hospitalized with an eating disorder for 3 months, and then part-time for 3 months. And she's fine now. She has a wonderful husband, fantastic grandchildren, and I'll be glad to show you pictures of them out there. But with that experience, I was devastated, just devastated. And then I saw a friend whose kid was schizophrenic. And then I had another friend whose daughter was dealing with drug addiction. And suddenly I realized that there are a lot of people in the world who are going through similar traumas. It's not like everybody's having a happy time with life. And I felt almost the way I did when I became a father, that I joined this wonderful club. But it made it real. It was really profound. That, and then I had five friends die within 3 years. And it was, I mean, these were very, very close friends, close enough that I was invited to offer a eulogy at each of their services. And I was grieving, but I was found myself grateful for this, the wonderful experience I'd had. They were just a lot of laughs, and boy, was I lucky that they were in my life. And the third thing was the birth of my first grandchild, who was three when we started filming. And one day I said to him, Ben, you know, I would rather be playing with you than anything else in the world right now. And he looked at me and he knew I meant it. And I could approach people having those three experiences because I could connect with anyone because I was honest. They knew I was honest. They knew I had suffered. They knew I would be forgiving or not judging. And the great thing I realized about those three experiences is you don't need a PhD. You don't need a super pedigree. And those are essentially open to most people.
Hi, Adam. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. Thanks for the work. Like a lot of people here, I'm sure I'm a lawyer, although don't practice in the criminal justice system. But one of the things that I've thought about over the years about this, and I would love your perspective on it, is in some ways it goes back to Sharon's question about do you throw the baby out with the bathwater given the state of the judicial system. Is part of it for me is as I look at judicial systems, I tend to think that they are always a mirror, a reflection of the societies from which they're derived. And I think I also think that they're a lagging indicator of the direction in which societies evolve. So the question is, so often I feel like when we're talking about issues of judicial reform, what we're really doing is kind of putting small chips into a much, much bigger problem, right? Like, maybe we can all agree that bail should be reformed. Maybe we can all agree that three strikes are a bad idea. But I think in the big picture, I worry that that is really gonna have a very minimal impact. And really, the problems that we see in our judicial system are really a function of the problems that our society is riven with. And how do you think about that, and how do you, you know, how do you approach it, and how do you not get awfully depressed by that?
You know, approaching this film the way I did, by no narrator, putting the audience in the shoes, I wanted people to see that the people behind bars are much more like us than unlike us. And until people can really identify with the defendants and with the guards and the other people administering the system, yeah, I do think it's going to be just at the margins. I do. And so I don't expect my documentary to change things overnight, but I feel like if it gets a conversation going, if it goes to people who feel alone right now in the battle, but they feel like, whoa, there's some other people who understand. And if other people join in the conversation, that's why it sounded like I was ducking Sharon's question before, but I really do think you have to change the minds because it's monumental to change the system.
So weird to make me loud. I own a house in Memphis, Tennessee that my disabled sister lives in. And all of my, there's no income tax in Memphis, or in Tennessee. So all of my friends are always like, well, I give 15% to the church. In filming this, and from your observation, where do the churches, and all the religious and spiritual institutions, how do they play into what is going on, and how do they provide aftercare? Because I know how hard it is to get social services in Memphis.
That is great. I went to several churches. I went to a black church with Judge Calloway, and where she teaches Sunday school, and that was great. I went to a white church where it was not progressive in the slightest, and I really began to get uncomfortable. There was a guy who was a broadcaster, a sports broadcaster in Nashville, very popular, retired deliberately at age 70 to become a missionary on death row. And I became really friendly with him. And the warden is more powerful than the governor and wouldn't let us film in the prisons. But he was evangelical. And I guess, you know, the way I'd answer that question is there is a strong religious strain throughout Tennessee, and I was disappointed that the white churches were more on the punishment side than on the redemption side or the healing side.
I'm Bob. My question is, in case your voter suppression project doesn't work out, a follow-up project that maybe you can do, or maybe you're in the process of doing. Sharon talked about the redemptive effect this had on the people who were able to tell their stories. I would love to know if it's ever possible to have the people who are depicted in your film to get their reaction after watching themselves through the lens of the documentarian. Not just the people who are incarcerated, but the probation officers and the deputy district attorneys and the public defenders. I would love to know if seeing themselves through the eyes of a third person has any personal impact on the way that they perceive themselves or their roles. I don't know if it's ever possible to follow up on that, but that's something that I think is a really important question, to talk about the personal impact, not just the societal impact.
Right. Right. We did have a screening in Nashville, and there were a lot of people who were in the film who were there. We couldn't get that many defendants to attend. Some were incarcerated, and some didn't want triggering experiences. But I've stayed in touch. I should have added this before. You know, when you get close to somebody, when you do interviews with them, there is this understanding, I'm going to treat you like a human being, but you can't run out. I'm not going to run out on you either. That's part of the agreement, the covenant, if you're going to make an arrangement to film somebody. So we get texts from people all the time. We're still in touch with them, almost everybody we covered. So we could do it that way. If you could finance us, that would be something really good, Bob. I'd like that.
This is an incredible conversation. I want to thank Michael, who's our sound person, who this is the first time that Michael has spoken in one of these sessions, but is here with us week after week, truly a world-class person who Hillel said, this will be transformative for us to have Michael on our team. And so I just want to thank you for being behind the scenes all the time and for your great question. To each of you who asked questions, I have to say, Marshall, I am so touched by the depth of your humanity and by especially your answer to Razel's question about the three human experiences. I think it was Razel's question that you answered this to, that the shared experience of trauma and worry for our children, the shared experience of loss and also gratitude that we were able to have those people in our life. I mean, this is so, and then the experience of of loving a tiny child in this world, and which is part of which is recognizing how vulnerable they are and how vulnerable we all are, that those very human shared experiences have so softened and opened your heart that you can actually see everyone in the fullness of their humanity, and what a gift that is to the world, and what a beautiful model it is for all of us. And so I'm just so deeply moved by your work. I can't wait to watch your show. I would like to watch every show with Rabbi Panitz, because your take on this is just stunning. And I'm so grateful to Melissa for insisting that we sit down in conversation together and just making this conversation possible. Thank you all for being here and sharing in this beautiful conversation. Really, really deeply, deeply moved.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll close with Birkat HaMazon. We'll start, and then if someone wants to take it, take the lead after we zoom in together.
I'll just jump in real quick, just to say one more time, Justice USA, available on Max. Go ahead and watch it, and then we can talk about it at Shabbos lunch next week and the next week and the next week.
Shir Hamalo Peshuv Adonai Yad Shiva Tzion Ayinu Kechom Mimaz Yimale.
Hi, it's Rabbi Brous again. Thank you so much for listening. Want more content like this? I hope you'll subscribe. And please consider making a contribution to IKAR so we can continue to work toward the fulfillment of our mission to reanimate Jewish life, to embody moral courage, to nurture the spirit, and to work to decipher what it means to be a human being in the world today. Visit our website at IKAR.org. That's IKAR.org. And I hope to see you, maybe even in person, sometime soon.